Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Over the past year, public health officials went from being the people who nudge us not to smoke, not to drink and drive, to eat our veggies, to being a highly visible arm of government involved in calling a lot of the shots.
Unless you need to go out, stay home.
Which businesses stayed open and which closed?
Indoor operations will be suspended at concert venues, casinos, gyms.
Who can go to work? Who can be in school? Ordering people to cover their nose and mouth.
Wear your mask.
Public health became powerful. Many people looked to them to keep all of us safe. Others felt suspicious and resentful. Like, who are these people to tell us what to do, to restrict our rights? Can we trust them? Trust has become a major issue of our time. Trust in information, trust in government, in science, in public officials. Last week, we explored scientific research and trust. On today's episode, the second part of our deep dive on trust, we look at public health and how they talk to us, the public. What gets people's attention and cooperation? What creates resentment and rebellion? Last year, during the summer, reporter Jad Slaman was covering COVID-related developments for WHYY's newsroom, getting an update on what was happening in Philadelphia. And he noticed something that didn't sit right with him. It was one of those gut feelings at first, but strong enough to send him on a chase to learn more. This story we're about to hear illustrates many of the main issues at stake, the delicate balance of risk communication and trust when lives are on the line. Here's Jad.
I remember very clearly the day I stopped totally trusting my city's health commissioner. It was the last Tuesday in July during a press conference. We were well into the pandemic. Stay-at-home orders were gone. Restrictions were kind of a hodgepodge. The Philadelphia Department of Health had been doing weekly press briefings over Zoom for months. They'd started to kind of blur together. Health Commissioner Dr. Thomas Farley always popped up to do his rundown of the state of the virus for the week. This press conference was no different.
Unfortunately, we are seeing increases in the coronavirus cases in the Philadelphia region. I'm going to summarize where we are with that.
There's always the trend line, up or down or about steady, and then some numbers. We were up to an average of 164 cases per day from 111 weeks earlier.
That 164 per day will likely increase in the next few days when we get the stragglers of cases reported. But you can see the overall increase. Now, the increase is partly related to increase in testing.
He said testing was up, that young people were testing positive more often, but that the city had yet to see an increase in hospitalizations. Run-of-the-mill stuff. He then shifted to national trends. There'd been a surge of virus in Sunbelt states that was now subsiding.
Daily case counts have been falling in some states that were the earliest surges in this second wave, specifically Arizona, Texas, and even Florida.
And then, kind of out of nowhere, he said this.
So in summary, the second wave of the epidemic has now reached Philadelphia.
Now, to be honest, I was kind of half paying attention before this, but perked right up. The second wave was supposed to be the big one. Federal health officials had been warning that it could dwarf the initial spring outbreaks. Dr. Farley went on, explaining indoor dining restrictions would stay in place longer, then back to the wave.
The second wave has simply hit us right now. To a certain extent, epidemics like this work in waves that travel geographically. Between March and May, there was an epidemic wave that more or less started in New York City and that spread south and west and hit Philadelphia on the way. Then, after southern states reopened too quickly and too recklessly, there's a second wave that started there and then is spreading north and east from there, and that wave has now just arrived in Philadelphia.
None of that made sense to me. He's describing the spread of the virus like it's a literal wave, washing north and east toward us from hotspots. I started trying to pull up maps of viral spread that could show this, and I couldn't find any. And something else about this didn't seem right. Farley said testing was up along with the case rise, so I did the math, and it turned out the rates of increase were exactly the same. 47% more tests, 47% more positive cases. Dr. Farley had said more testing was partly to blame for more cases. Grade school math showed it was probably almost entirely responsible, that the overall virus situation was more or less stable. Meanwhile, what Farley had announced at the press conference was already hitting the airwaves.
The second wave of the pandemic has hit here, along with an increase in coronavirus.
The second wave of the epidemic has now reached Philadelphia.
There's been a significant increase of coronavirus in the region, mainly among young
people. I didn't feel comfortable writing that kind of headline. So instead, I emailed the health department spokesperson with a long fact check that amounted to, I don't buy it. There's not really evidence the second wave has hit, that there even is one. The spokesperson sent me a lengthy response. The part that struck me was right at the end. He said, the media wants to point to a, quote, impressive graph with rapidly rising cases to show people cases are rising. The email continued, quote, public health officials, however, have a vested interest in keeping those case counts as low as possible, so we never have to show one of those graphs again. Dr. Farley is warning people that we are starting to see the hallmarks of a second rise in cases, and he's doing everything in his power to stop that from happening. We would rather call a slight increase in cases the start of a second wave than wait too long and have to deal with uncontrollable spread. Okay, so compare that fact check statement I got to what was announced in the press conference to everybody else.
The second wave has simply hit us right now.
It sounded to me like public health was saying a second wave was here in order to scare people into behaving cautiously enough to avoid a true second wave. I wanted a headline that said something like, no evidence for second wave. The editor, though, was, I guess, feeling more cautious. Went with, has the second wave of the pandemic hit Philadelphia? A little inside baseball. When a news headline asks you a yes or no question, the answer we're tipping you towards is almost always no. I was pretty nervous about this at the time. Like, who am I to question the head of a major American city's health department? To question a scientist protecting us from the pandemic? But as it turns out,
I definitely called it wrong.
There really was no second wave.
Because I said that the case rates were likely to rise, and they didn't rise, that they fell.
This is from a press conference near the end of September 2020. Cases fell following Dr. Farley's second wave announcement. I asked him, was I right to be skeptical in July? And does he worry his summer second wave announcement would harm his credibility if a true second wave hit in the late fall or winter?
You know, if people are hearing second wave since July, do you think people are going to be less inclined to believe it?
Well, as I said, I called it wrong then, and I think the lesson is that this is very unpredictable.
That's not the lesson I got. He didn't predict a wave back in July. He said it was here, that it had hit the city. I still believed COVID was real, and masks and social distancing and all that, but I no longer believed our public health department. Not completely. Why couldn't he have just said there's a slight rise in cases? Stay vigilant. Why call a second wave? Why speak with such certainty, with so little evidence, about something so scary? Was it for our own good? A message we needed to hear to cancel that innocent get-together with just a few friends? I wondered if this kind of framing, truth-shaping to nudge us in one direction, was this just a part of public health?
There are a lot of things about this pandemic that haven't happened in 100 years.
That's Peter Sandman, an expert in risk communication.
But public health being misleading in order to get people to do the healthy thing, that's not unique to this pandemic. That's absolutely typical.
Peter is actually kind of the grand old man of risk communication. He was one of the academics that essentially created the field in the 80s. He's retired now, sort of.
By 2019, I was completely retired. When COVID-19 reared its ugly head, it looked like a stupid time to be retired, given that, you know, I'd worked on bird flu, I'd worked on swine flu, I'd worked on Zika, I'd worked on Ebola. Seemed stupid not to come back for COVID-19, so I unretired.
Peter's had a decades-long career as a risk communication consultant and academic working for all manner of big-name environmental, public health, government, and corporate outfits. Everyone from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to the World Health Organization, from ConocoPhillips to Procter & Gamble. Over the years, he's noticed something about who he calls the good guys, the nonprofits, the government organizations with good-for-society altruistic goals, people like those in public health. He says they don't mind exaggerating the case for their cause here and there. They're the good guys after all. Their goals are good. They're not trying to make a buck. They want to save us.
You don't feel bad. You don't feel like you're misleading. You feel like you're saving lives. You know, and you are saving lives and you are misleading. And the most interesting question is that okay? You know, do we want a world in which public health people say things that aren't strictly true when, in their best judgment, doing so will lead to better health outcomes?
That's been the big question of the pandemic for guys like Peter. For governments and scientists, it's been a year-long exercise in critical global risk communication where the stakes have maybe never been higher. When Peter talks about less than truthful public health messages, he's referring most often to this one, in his mind, regrettable practice.
They gild the lily.
Gilding the lily. It means needlessly trying to improve an already good enough thing. He gives me an anti-smoking example.
One of the things that, you know, the Cancer Society endlessly says is corporations ought to do anti-smoking programs. Because your employees smoke, they get lung cancer, and that costs you a lot of money.
Peter used to be on the Public Information Committee for a state chapter of the American Cancer Society. At one point, they looked to an economic analysis to quantify this. How much money do smoking employees cost their companies? The only problem, it showed smoking could actually save employers money. Smokers died earlier than non-smokers, so fewer years of medical coverage, pension, and retirement payments.
Yeah, it's pretty grim.
it's grim. Yeah, but what we learned is that, you know, I mean, it wasn't like we were going to stop urging people to quit smoking because we want people to live as long as possible. But we should have stopped telling corporations that it was in their self-interest because we had learned that it wasn't.
Society literature does still argue smoking cessation saves corporate money. To Peter, it's an example of gilding the lily. He thinks the perfectly true argument that smoking greatly increases your risk of a slow and painful death is powerful enough on its own. Why stack the deck?
They don't trust the public. They think if you give a balanced argument, the public's likely to screw it up. And the best way to get the public to make the right decision is to pretend it's a no-brainer and there's no decision to be made.
But gilding the lily, it can be risky. Peter says that's become painfully obvious during the pandemic. Take the messaging about masks we heard early last year. At the time, public health agencies knew for certain hospitals would start running out of PPE and soon. And they also knew asymptomatic spread of COVID was possible.
They knew it could happen, but they genuinely didn't know how often it happens.
It was kind of an unknown. Masks then could be useful for the public, or maybe not. Nobody really knew for certain.
But that's not what they said. What they said is masks are useless in ordinary life.
The former U.S. Surgeon General actually said it using caps lock. Stop buying masks, he tweeted. They are not effective in preventing the general public from catching hashtag coronavirus. A more balanced message would have been social distance, stay home, you'll be safe enough. Don't buy masks because hospital workers need them more right now. The added messaging about the uselessness of masks, what fuels a great deal of mask denial to this day, to Peter, that's a gilded lily. He says it's still happening with vaccines. You may have heard the top three, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, are all 100% effective against death from COVID-19.
That's true in the sense that in all three phase three trials, nobody who was fully vaccinated after the period of time when the vaccine kicks in completely, nobody died.
When I talked to Peter, by the way, it was after I had lucked into a super early vaccination. My hospital just called me in out of the blue, and it felt kind of like I won the lottery. 100% death proof sounded great to me.
But in the placebo groups, almost nobody died. And, you know, I mean, I'm looking at the numbers here. I'll give you the Pfizer number because that's the most stunning. In the vaccine group, nobody died. In the placebo group, also, nobody died. So the argument that the Pfizer vaccine prevented death is exactly as strong as the argument that the Pfizer placebo prevented death.
So yeah, admittedly less jazzed about my ironclad vaccine after hearing that. And kind of stunned I somehow didn't know this already.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the vaccine. There's nothing wrong with the trials. There's something wrong with the sales pitch.
The vaccines are highly effective. The reason the placebo and the vaccine are so close when it comes to death is because the trials are so unusual. They didn't run for that long, warp speed and all, and we were all social distancing and wearing masks while it was going on. Really abnormal life patterns. Fewer people got the chance to be exposed to corona and eventually die of it than may have been exposed to disease X during another longer vaccine trial pre-pandemic. But so, should public health be touting the vaccines as 100% effective against death? And if they didn't say that, would so many people still be lining up, so eager for an experimental shot, using new technology on emergency use approval? I mean, honestly, what did you think 100% effective meant before Peter rained on everyone's parade?
We're listening to a story by Jad Slayman about framing public health messages in a way that maybe makes too strong of a case, but is meant to get people to behave a certain way. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, the price you pay if you don't dial up the urgency.
And now you're dealing with a bunch of people who have died as a result of you not acting soon enough.
That's still to come on The Pulse. I want to tell you about a podcast I really like. It's called Trade-Offs with Dan Gorenstein, and it's about health policy. And this is the kind of stuff that matters to all of us. It impacts our health, our wallets, and what kind of access to care we will have. And I promise this is not a double-decker wonk sandwich. Trade-Offs unpacks these issues in a really accessible and fun way. You can check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Last year during the summer, reporter Jad Slayman attended a press conference where Philadelphia's health commissioner announced that the second wave of coronavirus had hit the city.
The second wave of the epidemic has now reached Philadelphia.
Jad did the math, tests, and positive rate, and he saw that the rate of cases had not gone up. A deeper look into this announcement suggested that it was perhaps made in an effort to get people to be more cautious. He spoke to public health experts about this practice in communicating risks.
They don't trust the public. They think if you give a balanced argument, the public's likely to screw it up. They gild the lily.
Meaning they sometimes overstate the facts. Jad found another example of this in how effectiveness of vaccines was communicated in terms of preventing death. He picks up the story from here.
I reached out to Holly Wilkin about this. She's a health communication professor at Georgia State. I asked her about this message, that vaccines were 100% effective in preventing COVID deaths, when nobody died of COVID in the placebo group either. I wanted to know, isn't this misleading? Isn't it, you know, wrong? She says, a little, but...
Right now, you know, we want to get life back to normal. Presenting it in the simplest, most basic form that's going to get the most people to do the recommended health behavior now because we know that it's going to have... Well, we believe that it's going to have the biggest impact.
As I was first writing the script in late March, the virus was surging again in parts of Europe where, mainly for logistical reasons, the vaccination rate was much lower than here. I saw a headline about intubations in a packed hospital parking lot in Greece. Here in the States, more recently, the experts worry not enough people will get the shot for true herd immunity as demand has waned. So yeah, she's got a point. I wanted to talk to Holly because she trains future public health officials. It occurred to me that I didn't really know anything about these people, about their jobs pre-pandemic. I had been thinking of public health as a kind of objective scientific organ. Data and science tell us this and that, and so on such and such basis, we are now telling you this. And can you really blame me? They always say they're following the science, that data is making the decisions. But Holly says it's always been more complicated than that. Like Peter, she explains with a smoking example.
So we think of something like smoking, and most people think, oh, well, everybody knows that it's bad for you. Well, at what point in your life did you figure out that it was bad for you? And had they successfully already convinced you to try smoking?
They being big tobacco.
They're out there using persuasive messages, and they have big marketing budgets, and they're doing different things to convince people to do the unhealthy behavior. And so with very considerably smaller budgets, public health people have to figure out, okay, how do we counter those arguments that are out there?
To essentially punch above its weight class, public health has had to arm itself with more than just the plain and whole truth. They've had to use what Holly calls appeals. Precisely speaking, she means emotional appeals. They can be to sadness, to empathy, to guilt, but most often they've been appeals to fear. A classic example is the old "your brain on drugs" ads.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs.
The ads don't really tell you anything about addiction, how it develops, or how drugs work, or that they can be pretty fun, at least for a while. They just tell you, drugs will destroy you.
Any questions?
Fear can be very persuasive.
I had a doctor once tell me that, you know, communicating with patients isn't difficult at all. I just tell them they're going to die if they don't take these meds, and they do it.
The fear appeal can work quickly, but Holly thinks public health has leaned on it too much for too long during the pandemic. She discourages the fear appeal in general because she says studies have found it unpredictable. You never know how it's going to break, who it'll work on, or for how long. Some people get scared and stay scared. Some people get defiant. You end up with the battle cry of the anti-masker, which, tellingly, is not, "I don't care about grandma," it's, "I refuse to live in fear."
So we have what we call in media a third-person effect, where you don't necessarily believe the media is impacting you, but you believe other people would be impacted by particular things that they see or they hear in the media. And I think to an extent that the fear appeal is very much like that.
Fear appeals also appeal to us, to reporters, to news organizations. If it bleeds, it leads. That's true. And Holly says public health understands this. A fear appeal may get you headlines while another kind of appeal won't.
People might not be tuning into the press conferences anymore. And those that are then watching the news that might report on those press conferences, that at a certain point, I think people no longer start to see the human element, that they start to see you just having these increasing numbers.
I talked to Holly about Dr. Farley in the press conference I covered. He said the second wave had hit, and that's what a lot of outlets ran. What would the headlines have been if he had just said, "a slight rise in cases, keep an eye out"? Would there have even been any headlines? Dr. Farley didn't announce any new public health measures to go with the second wave announcement, but he also didn't remove any. Some restrictions were slated to be relaxed, and they were extended. Holly, though, she tells me just saying second wave, that is an active public health measure in and of itself. Just saying those words on TV, that can save lives.
What we're seeing now is this is really being spread within families and at social events.
That's Dr. Farley again, later in the July second wave press conference.
And so we're making our recommendation today to try to limit exposure within families and at social events.
What public health measure gets people to stop seeing their own families, especially during beautiful summer days after months apart? Maybe it's pulling the trigger on a fear appeal, a big one, like a second wave. To help me better understand Dr. Farley's situation, Holly gives me this example.
Back when I was in middle school, we had to do a game in our science class where each day we got to check the seismic readings of around Mount St. Helens and had to make a decision on whether or not you're going to evacuate the town or not.
Too early and people lose confidence in you. Like, we left and nothing happened, but make a move too late.
And now you're dealing with a bunch of people who have died as a result of you not acting soon enough.
Either way,
everybody who's around knows you made the right call or you didn't make the right call because an actual volcano explodes.
With pandemic public health, if you do everything right, the volcano never goes off. all is quiet when a crisis is averted, which can make prevention measures seem like total overkill. There is a possibility that Dr. Farley simply saying there's a second wave did something to stave one off. There really is no way to know. He wouldn't speak to me for this story, but I really wish he would've. I wrote to his spokesperson that I wanted to know what I didn't know, the factors Dr. Farley weighed behind closed doors before deciding to declare a second wave, the pressure he felt. I don't know what it's like to be in his position, to make life and death decisions, even if indirectly, for an entire city. There's a strong case Dr. Farley did gild the lily, but he's definitely saved more lives than I have this past year. The question then becomes, at what cost? I live in a deep blue city, run in progressive circles. Most people I know want to believe the Dr. Farleys of the world. But what about others? People who don't trust experts or officials, those who believe COVID conspiracies or think the virus is no worse than the flu, a ploy to control us. Peter Sandman, the expert on risk communication, says gilding the lily, overstating some things while keeping quiet about others, that can become jet fuel for misinformation, for conspiracy theories.
The easiest way to find out the pieces of the truth that public health isn't looking at, let's take vaccination, for example, the easiest way to find out the small percentage of the truth that's genuinely anti-vax is to read anti-vax websites. And you have to wade through a lot of falsehood, but you'll also find the little pieces of truth that public health is pretending don't exist.
It's like this. What if instead of Peter telling you a trial found no difference between placebo and vaccine in terms of death, it's someone ranting about it on YouTube? He's red in the face, screaming all kinds of scary nonsense, but then he says something about Pfizer that A, is true, B, is kinda troubling, and C, that no mainstream authority bothered telling you. How does that change who you believe? What does that do to who you trust? But maybe that's a peacetime concern. We're still in a war against this virus. It's hard to know the right move, especially when dealing with imperfect, irrational humans. I have been, throughout this story, really asking two questions. How much can we trust public health? And how much does public health trust the public, trust us? But Holly brought up a third, harder question. How much trust does the public deserve? We were talking about masks.
I have friends that live in the US, but, you know, were born in China or in other places in Asia. And they were all going, oh my God, why are they not telling us to wear face masks? You know, face masks help.
She started to say the messaging should have been straightforward. No appeals at all, just the complicated reality. But then she remembered toilet paper.
Was the rationale that they were afraid that people were going to hoard the face masks like they hoarded toilet paper.
It's nice to think we would have all banded together in a patriotic, scientifically infused fervor to protect our meager mask supply. But honestly, I doubt we would have. We're the country of Black Friday sales stampedes, after all. Ammunition sales spiked right alongside toilet paper. And Peter says there is a hazard in trusting the public with too much science. They realize that it's imperfect, that it can be and is wrong all the time. Still, he's settled on honesty is the best policy. The whole truth, warts and all, as often as you can.
It's my argument in the longer term that the lives they save by misleading us are not worth it because their credibility is at stake and they should be honest even at the cost of their campaigns being less effective. That's my opinion. I cannot prove it. I don't have good data.
If the pandemic truly is once in a century, any gilding the lily, any fear appeal stretched too far, maybe public health gets away with it. By the time the next pandemic comes along, maybe all anyone will remember is science saved everyone. Miracle vaccines in record time. But if that's not the case, as some epidemiologists predict, Peter says above honest public health, above trustworthy and transparent public health, what's most important now is accountable public health.
Don't expect to be trusted. Don't ask to be trusted. Don't want to be trusted. What you should want to be is accountable.
I am thankful for the efforts Dr. Farley and others in public health have made during this past terrible year. They chose to serve, to try and protect the health of their communities, to protect me. I know that impulse is likely behind every decision, right or wrong. So as for me, I won't believe or not believe everything Dr. Farley says. I'll treat him like a reporter should treat any city official talking from behind a podium. I'll listen, but with a healthy dose of adversarial, respectful doubt. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Listen to me, Lil, and to what I've got to tell ya. I've been through the mill, and I don't wanna sell ya. But the game of love is hard to understand. So here's some good advice. Never overplay your hand. Don't gild the lily, lily.
We were listening to Jad's story as a way to better understand why talking about public health can be so tricky. If you undersell the case, people might die. If you overstate the risks, people will call you a fearmonger. Maybe they'll stop trusting you. But what makes this job especially tricky, this job of keeping people healthy and safe, is that it so often involves telling us what we should or shouldn't do. And that can get people pretty mad. Like, who's this person to tell me if I can go to the gym or not? Why are you telling me how to live my life? Historically, public health has perhaps come off a bit like a nagging parent, keeping us on the straight and narrow. And think about some of the big public health issues: addiction, smoking, obesity, sexually transmitted diseases. These are things that used to be referred to as vices. So there's a bit of a moral undertone. I talked about that with Howard Markel. He is a historian of public health and medicine at the University of Michigan. He told me that in the past, our concept of vice was based in religion and enforced through laws, but
as the authority, the moral authority of religion began to wane in the 19th century, and a lot of historians date that tipping point to Darwin's publication of Origin of Species in 1861, but it becomes more of the authority of science, of medicine, and of course of law.
So where does health come into the picture? Maybe let's start by talking about how are health and morals intertwined, or our concept of health?
Very deeply, and it's very hard to untangle that helix of morality and health. You know, a lot of public health, when it emerged in the mid to late 19th century, was very much intertwined with various religious denominations. And a lot of people who were proponents of protecting the public's health were very much involved in their church or their synagogue or their mosque. So a lot of laws that were developed, a lot of public health laws that were developed, were based on the morality issues of, say, prostitution or homosexuality or the spreading of disease and the use of so-called illicit substances. But it's really only begins in the 20th century that these laws are put on the books and public health authorities are charged with prosecuting them. Late 1890s, but it's a 20th century phenomenon largely.
Public health is hopefully based in science, but do you think public health people spend enough time just thinking about what are the moral or ideological underpinnings that I'm working on, the base that I'm standing on when I'm thinking about this?
Absolutely. Are we stigmatizing this person because of this practice or this protocol? And there is a great deal of time, energy, and research spent discussing these issues. And I can tell you, when I look at epidemics past, I don't see historians or bioethicists at the table. Now, people like me are always at the table talking about this or that protocol and looking into the potential for stigma.
So public health people are not a sort of Puritan modern-day vice squad.
Well,
To take the fun out of my life.
Take the fun out of your life. No, we have parents for that. No, I mean, look, they're not a monolithic group of people. There's hundreds of thousands of people in that field. Some may be very moralistic. Some may be very judgmental. But as a group and the way it's taught and the way it's considered, I think things have changed quite a bit since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. That's not the only driver of this trend, but it was a big part of it. The job of a public health officer is not to take the fun out of your life. The job is to help you live a healthier and longer life and a more productive life. Now, it may seem that taking away your ginormous soda pop is taking the fun out of your life, but I would argue that it's quite the opposite.
Howard Markel is a historian of public health and medicine at the University of Michigan. We're talking about public health today, why people trust the messages they hear or not. Coming up, a conversation with an epidemiologist who is fluent in science, vaccine research, and scripture.
The mark of the beast is something in Revelation. It's supposed to be a mark in the end times. And the Christian space has heard theories on what the mark of the beast is for decades and decades and decades. So the latest one is a conspiracy theory about the vaccines or mask being mark of the beast.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about public health, trust, and communication. How do you talk to people that have very little trust in what you're saying? And perhaps they think you're part of an evil force.
What you don't know is there's a serpent loose. There's a serpent loose, eager to hit it.
A recent poll from the Pew Research Center found that 45% of white evangelical Christians said they would not get the coronavirus vaccine. That means millions of people.
The white evangelical group is a good proportion of the U.S. population. So we have some work to do to get the message out, to get more of them to get vaccines to reach herd immunity.
Emily Smith, an epidemiologist at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, thinks she's able to reach this group in a way others can't because of who and where she is. She's a woman of science.
And I'm also in the buckle of the Bible Belt here in Texas, married to a Baptist pastor. And I got into epidemiology because I see it as a story of the Good Samaritan, of quantifying who is most in need for any disease or health disparity and choosing not to walk by.
Emily started breaking down scientific info for people early on in the pandemic. Her social media sites are called Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist.
I really try to keep the friendly, the neighborly part. You know, if I could talk with people in real life, I would probably have you at my kitchen table with cookies. That's just my personality. So I do try to keep that.
She says she gets millions of visitors every month across platforms, a lot of them white evangelical Christians. Early on, it was answering questions like, can we go to church? Can we have a barbecue? Should we wear masks? That kind of thing. And that friendly, neighborly tone was easy to keep going.
All of us had this sense of solidarity, flatten the curve, protect our neighbors, protect our healthcare workers, including in the church space. You know, I've met with hundreds of pastors at this point. And over time, I started seeing this split between faith and science. And the split happened because of the political ideologies that happened in 2020. And I get in trouble every time I talk about this because some will say, don't bring politics into it. But you have to bring politics into it to see where the rhetoric happened.
The more politicized the pandemic became, the more bad information Emily found herself fighting against.
That was the frustrating part, because the anti-science sentiment, or saying that the virus was a hoax or masking is a sign of fear, you don't need to mask. And now with vaccines, these conspiracy theories of it's the mark of the beast or it's going to ruin our immune systems, those were only coming from faith spaces. And at the beginning, it was far right spaces, but those have become a little bit more mainstream now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it all became this one messy thread of faith over fear. And the part that I don't think faith communities recognize enough, and I'm really trying to do my educational work to let them see, is that the same people who were saying faith over fear, those groups have really infused this global domination, mark of the beast, vaccines are going to ruin our immune system. Those conspiracy theories, there's a lot of overlap between the anti-maskers from a faith freedom perspective and then what we're seeing now with vaccines.
But people don't usually seem to recognize when they contradict themselves, right?
Yes, right, right. Yeah, there's a lot of education that needs to happen. And these, you know, they're good people sharing really awful anti-science stuff, thinking that it's truth. So there's a lot of work to debunk what they don't know that they're actually reading right now.
Now, a word about this mark of the beast thinking that Emily mentioned. It's a biblical reference that has become wrapped up in conspiracy theories.
The mark of the beast from a Christian faith perspective is something in Revelation. It's supposed to be a mark in the end times. And the Christian space has heard theories on what the mark of the beast is for decades and decades and decades. And so there's been a lot of things that people have said, this is the mark of the beast, and then this is the mark of the beast. So the latest one is a conspiracy theory about the vaccines or mask being mark of the beast. And it's a warped way of viewing something that's actually life-saving as a mark towards something that is anti-Christian or anti-faith. It's a way for certain groups to play on people's fear.
Emily says anti-vaccine sentiments are growing in this group.
I want to be clear, you know, there's a spectrum of waiting and seeing, of being a little nervous about the vaccines, all the way to just believing their global domination and the microchip. So I want to give a nod to the ones that are just nervous about it, because it looks like it's new technology, even though it's not. So that group, they're not the anti-vax camp. What is happening, though, is a lot of the anti-science, anti-vax groups are now infusing this new vaccine hesitancy group in really sneaky ways.
So to me, it sounds like what you were saying is that there may have been some anti-vaccine attitudes among white evangelicals before the pandemic, but now that fraction is growing.
Absolutely.
How important do you think the messenger is when communicating information? Are you more likely to be trusted because you are the wife of a minister, because you are a Christian?
I hope so. I do think that helps let people know that I'm just a real person. I've got two children. I understand the church world. From an evangelical perspective, I do think that helps build some trust. That, you know, when I talk about science and wearing a mask and love for neighbor, I don't have a propaganda or an agenda that is anti-faith. I hope that it helps people trust, you know, what I'm saying and where I come from.
How important do you think is it to tailor the message in terms of what the other person might be open to hearing? You know, I'm thinking sometimes you may bring your faith into the conversation. Sometimes you may use a mom example, you know, Do you try to directly speak to people where they can hear you?
Yeah, I think I do that naturally, just in my normal conversations. So when we were talking about schools, I talked about this is what I would do with my children. What about playing with friends on the playground? Here's what I'm doing with my kids. And the faith aspect, for sure. You know, we have a lot of friends that are pastors all over the nation in big and small churches. And so I try to keep them in mind of what would I write to you when you're thinking through these reopening issues. So I think tailoring is really important.
Emily says she's gotten some pushback for this work. On her pages, you will see the usual mean-ish comments like, why is it your business if I'm wearing a mask, that kind of thing. But she says the comments have gotten worse over time.
I mean, some that have come to the house, that is new for me. I mean, I'm a scientist pastor's wife. You're not really trained to figure out how to deal with that. But those are very scary. And, you know, just some really nasty stuff about blaming immigrants. There's always threats and messages that come. And I'm a mom. That's scary for my kids.
Yeah. And these were threats on your, including threats on your life, right?
Yes. Right. And in today's world, you also don't know what will happen. And if people are just saying that because you can just say whatever you want on social media, or if you really should be worried and cautious.
Yeah. But you still are committed to doing this work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we have things in place now for safety as good as we can from an online and just a home perspective. But I'm just committed to doing the work because it's the ones that will be affected the most from this pandemic are essential workers and those already on the margins for poverty. And so I just feel such a sense of obligation, especially from a Christian perspective, to be the Good Samaritan and hopefully get people to band together and still wear their mask and get a vaccine to not walk by too.
I wanted to ask you about, you are an insider in this group of evangelical Christians, which gives you a certain level of trust, I would think, within that group. You're also an insider in the group of scientists. But on some level, this pandemic has perhaps pushed you to be an outsider in both groups, because people in the science community are often not that kind to the faith community and vice versa. So how do you navigate those inside-outside roles?
That's a great question. When I look back on that in a few years, I'll probably have a better answer to it. I think you can't make everybody happy. But I do know the goal is to help those on the margins and their families stay alive and well, and knowing that we're all connected. So I just try to keep that in mind and that I'm just not going to make everybody okay.
Emily Smith is an epidemiologist at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. You can find her on social media as Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist. Before we go, maybe tell me about a post or a message you received that makes your day, that keeps you going.
Oh, there's several of them. I think when I get the ones from moms and they heard different things maybe from their friends or their pastors that were not correct, that they read what I wrote and they went and got their vaccines and then they send pictures of being able to hug their parents that they hadn't seen in a year. That means the world to me that they trusted me enough to do that, that they could connect with their families.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.